Welcome to Stories. I'm your host, Sean Ketchum. In this season, I take a trip down to Nashville to learn about the city's vibrant startup and entrepreneur culture. In each episode, I speak in depth with someone who founded a company there. My goal is to learn about their story and how that led to them starting their company. A few quick disclaimers about this episode. First, we talk a lot about beer. So this episode is for individuals of the legal drinking age, which is 21 here in the US. Second, I personally would never recommend drinking to anyone under the legal drinking age, or anyone even of the legal drinking age but has never drank before. So if you don't drink alcohol, good for you. Third, if you are currently struggling with alcohol abuse or have struggled with alcohol abuse in the past, this might not be the best episode for you. And if that is you, I'd also like to provide you with a phone number that may be of help. It's the Department of Health and Human Services toll-free number for alcohol and drug information and treatment referral assistance. If you need that number, it's 1-800-662-4357. Okay, now it's time to get into this episode. With all of the above being said, if you are a beer lover, such as myself, you will very much enjoy this episode with none other than Ben Bredesen. Ben is the founder and owner of Fat Bottom Brewing Company, which he started in Nashville in 2012. And let me tell you, their beer is good. Now, introducing Ben Bredesen. I hope you guys enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I'm sitting here with my new good buddy, Ben Bredesen, owner and founder of Fat Bottom Brewing Company. And we are on site here at Fat Bottom. I just kind of want to set the scene for you guys. We are in an office, or conference room rather, and there are a lot of beers around us. I think Ben's got four beers in front of him. I got about six or seven if you include the one I finished. It's not as bad as you're thinking, folks. Ben was kind enough to give me a flight of different beers. And for folks that don't know what that is, Ben, tell me, go ahead and tell folks what a flight is.
All right. So, when you go to a brewery tap room and ask for a flight, you'll basically get samples of a lot of different beers. So we do 4-ounce samples, but I guess they could be pretty much any size. Just let you taste a lot of things without having too much beer at one time.
Yep. And so Ben was, he was letting me taste a few of his beers. And was kind enough to give me a tour around the brewery. Thanks very much. Can we talk about what we were doing right before we
put the podcast? Let's do it.
So explain to folks, and this will give you, okay, just to clarify, yeah, I do have a flight of beers. That's going to cover four of the seven I was describing. And now the other three have to do with what we were doing right before we hit record. And so Ben, can you explain to folks what we were doing?
Yeah, so one of our brewers had tasted one of our beers and thought that there was something wrong with it. So what we did is we set up a triangle test with that beer. And a triangle test is it's a discrimination test. You pour two of something and one of another thing. And the panel that tastes it basically has to determine which one of the three is different. And if you consistently figure out what's different, that you know something is actually different about that beer, whether it be good or bad.
Very cool. I want to get more into beer in a little bit, but I just kind of want to start by talking about you and some of the beginnings. Where are you from?
I grew up here in Nashville. I was a native, born and raised, went away to school, and ended up coming back.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Brown University.
Brown, cool. And is that Rhode Island?
Yep, Providence, Rhode Island.
Providence, Rhode Island, yeah. I had a friend that went to Brown. Actually, one of my closest friends, it's her cousin. I think he went there undergrad, and then I think he's doing medical school, or he finished maybe. And what did you study at Brown?
I studied computer science, which I'm sure most people would guess from the whole brewing job, but
science. Of course, a little sarcasm in there. I'm like, hold on, I'm actually thinking, I'm like, how does that fit in there? So why computer science? When did you originally get into computers and coding?
So I actually, I grew up around computers. My father was a computer programmer starting back in the 60s. And that was always prominent when I was growing up in the 80s. And I mean, I don't know. It's just always part of my life. I always loved computers. I mean, certainly games as a kid, but, you know, he also taught me some programming. And once I got to be a teenager, got pretty heavily into computer programming.
So your dad was even teaching you to program before you were a teenager. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true.
What was the first language that your dad was showing you?
The first language I ever worked in, it was BASIC on a Commodore 64.
Cool. And for folks that are too young to understand what that is, could you explain, what is a Commodore 64? Is this something that Microsoft made, or what is this?
No, it was a Commodore 64 was a very early PC. This was sort of mid-80s time frame. And it was very different than even the old DOS PCs. You basically booted the thing up, and you were dropped into a programming interpreter. So to load a program, you had to write a program. And so it was very, very, very different than the tablet experience of today.
What was the first program that you actually wrote? Was it a game or was it something else?
It was a game, in fact. There were a bunch of little exercises coming out of books and so on that I did. But yeah, the first program I wrote was a little game I started making with a friend of mine.
Can you tell us about the game?
Not much, because this is probably when I was 8. I don't remember a whole lot about it, but
okay.
I remember we were having a lot of trouble saving information on the computer, and we're like, all right, we'll just tell people to write it down on a piece of paper and carry it with them, and that'll work, right?
Yeah. That's funny. What was your favorite subject in school before going to college?
I was always into science and math, physics and calculus, all that stuff really got me going, got me excited, interested. Astronomy was another one I really, really enjoyed.
And what was it about those subjects? Was it that you were more naturally, I don't know if I want to say like talented, or you understood that those subjects easier, or what was it about it that fascinated you?
I think part of it is it just made more sense to me, but a lot of it is I liked, I guess, the analytical side, sort of the way that you can model and describe the world with mathematics. It just made more sense to me than literature or history or things like that.
Were you involved in any extracurricular activities in high school, whether it be sports or otherwise?
Yeah, I did. I was a runner, which I have not run since high school. I just fell out of that entirely. I did a lot of outdoor stuff, just a lot of camping and hiking and biking, a lot of art, did a lot of photography, some painting, a bunch of different things, I guess.
You mentioned art, which is a little intriguing, because I think when a lot of folks think of people that are more geared toward math and science, they think of creativity and art as sort of the polar opposite. Do you feel that that's the case, or do you think that's wrong?
Well, I think there's a bridge there. If you take hard sciences at one end of the spectrum and arts at the other end, I kind of look at engineering as sitting between there. You got the creativity, but it's also a very structured discipline. There's obviously a lot of science and math that goes into engineering of any kind. But it is very creative at the same time.
Of the different arts, what did you like the most?
I was very big in photography, did a lot of that. I really like sculpture. I did painting. I was never great at painting, but I enjoyed it. And it was something I did not expect to study computer science in college. I really thought I'd go to art school. Ended up doing a summer art program when I was 15, I believe.
Okay.
And actually, that's how I found Providence and kind of fell in love with that city, as I went to Rhode Island School of Design, which is right down the hill from Brown.
Mm-hmm. And what did you guys do in that program?
That was focused on sculpture, but it was very much like being in college. I mean, it was, I think it was 6 weeks long over the summer. I mean, you lived in the dorms at RISD and, went to class, and you're basically on your own, which is a pretty big deal for a 15-year-old.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Any late nights during that and hanging out with friends?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a suite with, I think, 4 double rooms. So you basically, you're around these guys all the time and hanging out. But it's cool because everybody had some different discipline they were interested in. I mean, there was a guy in there that did fashion design, and there were people who did painting, and people who were into drawing and printmaking and industrial design. So there's a lot of... just a lot of different ideas floating around. It was a pretty cool experience.
Yeah, it sounds pretty fun. Let's talk about photography a little bit. Now, when you were getting into photography, this was film.
Am I wrong? That's right. It was on film. Yep.
Were you shooting 35 millimeter?
I started 35 millimeter and I ended up getting a medium format camera, which is, I still have, I don't have a darkroom anymore, but still have the camera. I keep thinking about building a darkroom and picking that up again. But it's, you know, I've got two kids and describing photography on film to them when they can pick up a cell phone and take a photo it doesn't make any sense to them, right?
Sure,
they just don't understand it.
And did you process your own film at any point?
Yep. Yeah, I processed and did my own prints and did everything.
Okay. So for folks that may not have had any experience taking pictures with film, could you describe the process from taking the photo to actually having a printed photo? Could you go through? Because I think there's more than one process. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So one of the things with film is you have to be very aware of the capabilities of your camera. You have to be aware of the light that you're taking photos in. There's not a lot of automation with those older cameras. Certainly there were some levels of automation, but you had to be aware of those. You had to set your exposures. Typically I would sort of go over and underexposed. So if I was taking a photo, I'd take three or four versions of it. And then when you go into the darkroom, you have to make decisions about how you're going to develop that film. You may choose to overdevelop or underdevelop based on the conditions for that roll of film and what you're taking. So there's a lot of note taking and record keeping of exactly what each frame was and when you took it and what you were trying to do with it. And then once you had that film developed, you had to determine what you wanted to print. You had to frame it with your projector and then just do a lot of tests to make sure it's printing exactly the way you want it, not being overexposed or underexposed on the paper.
So first you have to get the film processed before you can do the prints.
Right. Yeah. So the film has to basically go into a chemical bath that takes what's on the film that's been exposed to light and turns it into dark areas, and the rest of it gets washed away. So it's sort of a clear, basically a clear sheet of plastic with the negative image printed on it. And then you take that and you reverse the negative when you print on the paper. So you're really getting the original positive image.
And how does printing on paper work? Like, how do you take that negative and blow that up to an image that you can hold in your hand?
So it's, you basically have to put that film into a machine that's like a projector. So it's got a lens and a light behind it. Determine how big you want the final image by moving that whole assembly up and down on a post. And then you have to frame the paper. So you literally block off pieces of it so that it won't get exposed to light. And then you start, like I said, doing tests to basically how many seconds of exposure do I want to have on this paper? Or how dark does that make the image? And it takes a long time to produce a single image. It's very different than, you know, taking a photo and dropping it into Photoshop and sort of playing with the levels. I mean, it could take days to get a single finished picture out of a darkroom.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about Brown a little bit. And actually, I'm actually more interested in talking about your major first. Now, you mentioned you thought you were going to go to art school. You thought you would do that. Why did you end up pursuing computer science instead?
When I got to college, I didn't think I would be doing that. I actually hadn't even considered it as a major. Originally, I wanted to do biology and be pre-med, and then I thought chemistry, and then I thought urban design, and just, you know, I was jumping around a lot that first year, trying different things out.
And you're already in Brown at this point.
Yeah, this is my freshman year, mm-hmm, in Brown. I ended up, a friend of mine had gone in planning to start in computer science and started telling me about the class. And, you know, I thought just on a whim, essentially, I would go ahead and take the introductory computer science class my sophomore year. And I mean, within the first week, I was in love with it. I sort of remembered everything I had done as a kid with the programming and kind of how much farther ahead things were. This is 99. Like I said, I just fell in love with it, said, this is what I want to study, and immediately kind of shifted all my major and essentially had to complete that program in 3 years because I started a year late.
Okay, so you started a year late, but you graduated from Brown still in 4 years?
Yep.
And then what did you do after Brown?
So after Brown, I had spent so much time in the lab that I really did not want to do that anymore. So I ended up getting a job doing finished carpentry. I made cabinetry and furniture in a shop over in Bristol, Rhode Island.
quite a change in scenery.
It's a big jump from computer science, but that was another thing that I had done growing up. My father had always been into woodworking. We did a lot of different projects. It was something that I had some experience in, but I'd never done at that level of precision. I mean, you know, cabinet making, as you know, is very, very precise. And kind of like the film photography, this is before CNC machines and kind of the automated process that shops use today. So we were doing everything by hand and, you know, putting together cabinets and going and installing them in kitchens and bathroom renovations.
You mentioned something that I wanted to ask you about with being in the lab in college. Now, what do you mean by that, by being in the lab?
Well, it is a very intense field. You know, I would routinely spend 30 plus hours in a chair writing code, working on projects.
And this is like in the library or a computer lab?
In computer labs, in that building, which I loved. I mean, I still love programming, but it was just, I needed to take a step away. I had, you know, basically devoted 3 solid years of doing nothing but thinking about code and, you know, learning everything from computer graphics to artificial intelligence to, you know, operating system design. And I was not ready to spend the next couple of years doing exactly the same thing. I just needed some time away, a little bit of time off.
And what did you learn in those, in the time that you were working, doing woodworking and such?
So, it may sound a little trite. The number one lesson I learned is to just be aware every action. What are the consequences? What can go wrong? And what I mean by that, I mean, at a very trivial level, it's if I'm carrying a ladder through somebody's house because I need to go hang a cabinet, if I turn too quickly, I'm going to put a hole in their wall. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I've kind of carried with me to where every action has consequences. Sometimes there's things you can't predict, and it's made me much more deliberate in my decision making and much more essentially sort of looking forward and trying to figure out what are the effects of doing this, of making this decision.
Mm-hmm. How long were you working in carpentry and woodworking?
So I spent, it was a little more than a year, maybe 16 months, 18 months doing that. And I was living with my wife at the time, girlfriend at the time. We decided we wanted to move back to Nashville.
And where were you living at? Were you still in Rhode Island?
Yep. I was living in Providence and driving over to Bristol. And she was working, managing a Ben & Jerry's shop, right by Brown, in fact.
In Bristol, when you say driving out of Bristol, you mean Bristol, Rhode Island?
Yeah.
Because there's a Bristol, Tennessee as well.
Right, yeah. Bristol, Rhode Island. It's probably, I don't know, 30 or 40 minute drive from where I lived. Okay. Bristol's a cool town. It's where a lot of the boat building goes on. So a lot of America's Cups boats are built there, a lot of pleasure yachts. It was just a cool environment to be in because you're right on the bay and you're kind of seeing all this naval industry going on. It's a cool place.
Yeah, sounds pretty interesting. So you decided that after a little over a year, year and a half, that you wanted to come back to Tennessee, to Nashville. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What did you do when you came to Nashville?
Well, I went back into software. So I came back. I was looking for, you know, some job in technology and ended up at a healthcare company writing medical record software.
And did you find it difficult getting a job being that you graduated, but you kind of went and did this thing that was a bit different, that wasn't in your field for a couple of years, a year or two? Did you find it difficult being able to find a job?
No, it was not that difficult. I think if I was trying to go to, you know, a Google or a company like that, it could have been a little harder. I did not search for very long. I think my first day was a month after I moved back to Nashville.
Okay. And how long were you there for?
Oh, let's see. 8 years, I believe. It was about that. I think 8 years I was there.
Tell me about sort of how your role at that company evolved over those 8 years.
So I actually started in customer support. I was answering phones, filing issue tickets, fixing some small bugs. Ended up getting moved into I guess we'd call an architecture role. The company wanted to build a new version of the software, something that was a little more scalable. And they asked me and another guy to kind of take on that project and re-engineer the system and build it for the future. That was, I'd have to think, maybe a year, year and a half after I started there. And from there, went out and built the system and then ended up becoming the development manager for that company and did that for a few years. So managing the development team and hiring the programmers and that sort of thing.
I'm going to take a slight tangent and tell you guys about something that I meant to mention earlier. So we're hanging out in this conference room, having a couple of beers, and there is a ping pong table in the room next door. And I thought about it because I see a couple of guys out there through the window of the door playing ping pong. I think we're going to bounce around a little bit, but I think that sort of tugs at a question I wanted to ask you, which is, how would you describe your company culture here at Fat Bottom Brewing Company?
I guess fun would be a word. Certainly, this is a job and people come here for a career and get paid, but that's not the only reason people are here. I want people to love being here, not just working here, but being here, spending time with the other folks they work with. The ping pong's a good example. That's something that we started when we were over in East Nashville. We would walk across the street to Smith & Lenz Brewing, another brewery in the neighborhood. They had some ping pong tables, and we sort of started picking it up and playing and got really into doing that in the evenings. And so that was one of the things we kind of built into this new space, is we wanted a little bit of entertainment and just a place that, people from the company could hang out and, enjoy a beer together and spend a little time that's not just focused on work, not just focused on making beer or selling beer, but being a part of this community.
When did you find community to be something that was really valuable to you?
First day. Not the first day, first week, I should say.
First week starting
the business.
Starting the business,
yeah.
Okay.
I was a kid growing up in middle school who didn't want a partner in science lab. I just wanted to go do it on my own, take care of it, not have to worry about somebody else. And when I started the company, that was my initial approach. I'm just going to do it all, right? I'm going to be brewing, and I'm going to do the books, and I'm going to do the sales and the delivery and the website and everything. And that's just not realistic. One of the things I learned very quickly is, one, you can't do it all. And two is there's things that I'm not good at. And so I needed to bring people in who were already in the company to do those things, right? Do the things that they enjoy, that they were good at. They had awareness, right? That sort of that sense of finding what everybody can do well and what they want to do. It's not possible if you're not, if it's not a community, if you're not friendly with people. I went through sort of a lot of ups and downs of the software company. We went through layoffs and then kind of brought it back up to being a really healthy company. And one of the things I saw is that if there's people who are unhappy, it creates a poisonous environment. You have to have people on board who are excited to be there, whether it's a good day or a bad one, and have a group of people that they can lean on, they can help each other, and that want to help each other. We talk about it over on the restaurant side that servers are making a lot of their income from tips, but that doesn't mean that you want to, or that you don't want to help the guy next to you in the next section, right? If that table is dirty, go ahead and bust it on your way back to the kitchen, because you're helping out your buddy and they're going to help you out too.
So we left off in your story when we were talking about the software company that you were working for when you came back to Nashville. What was the name of that company?
Qualifax was the name of the company.
Qualifax. Now, when you left Qualifax, did you leave Qualifax to start Fat Bottom Brewing?
I did. Yeah. I tried to leave at one point. I told the CEO I was moving on, and I was in sales at that point, and he sort of came back to me the next day and he said, I really don't want you to leave. We really need the following things, kind of some marketing focus, and asked me to really take on that project. And I kind of caved in and said, all right, I'll do that because I want to help the company out. And I did that for probably another year, year and a half. And at that point, I just said, look, I've always wanted to have my own business. I'm going to go make this happen. And left Qualifax and founded Fat Bottom.
Very cool. Now, I want to talk about how you got into brewing beer, but before I do that, I want to ask you about your tattoos, if that's okay.
Please.
I think you have tattoos on, is it both of your forearms?
Yep, both forearms.
Could you describe to people what these tattoos are?
Yeah. So on my left arm, I have a cicada, which is it's much larger than real life. It's probably about 6 or 7 inches long.
And what is a cicada for folks that might not be familiar?
So a cicada is a very large insect. It looks, I don't know, how would you describe that? Almost
it,
like a
it
fly
looks
with
like
giant
a
wings.
Moth or something? Maybe a fly or a moth. It has definitely a huge wing.
So it's cicadas are certainly endemic to Nashville. I mean, all summer you hear them chattering in the trees. And one of the things that fascinates me about them is there are certain broods that stay underground for years.
What's a brood? Is that like a community of these bugs?
It's more like a generation is probably a better way to put it. So so the brood that's local to certain Nashville and in Tennessee is on a 13-year cycle. So these insects come out of the ground once every 13 years. They climb, they lay eggs in the bark of trees, and then basically the eggs hatch and the newborn insects go and they bury back down in the ground and they sit there for another 13 years. And it's just a fascinating sort of pattern of life. But, you know, on top of that, it's very representative of Nashville in the summer to me.
And what about on your other arm?
So on my other arm is a mockingbird. Okay. And again, it's, you know, very much something you see constantly in Tennessee in the summer. And so the kind of the background, the inspiration on these was sort of an introvert extrovert thing. When I was younger, I was very much an introvert. And I'm kind of right in the middle right now. But it's it was just sort of this is home and this is who I am. It's that sort of duality of you know, mockingbirds sitting there chattering, but also doesn't really get along with other mockingbirds versus cicadas who are silent for, you know, a decade or more and then come out and make a huge, huge amount of noise for a few weeks in the summer.
Very interesting. All right, let's talk about beer a little bit. When did you first fall in love with beer?
Wow. I would say in college, really. When I was in college, I drank all the normal sort of terrible beers. I think Stroh's was the beer of choice for most of the fraternities.
Were you in a fraternity?
I was not. Fraternity life is not very strong at Brown, but I had some friends who were. And one day I went into the beer store and I was going to just kind of get whatever. And they had a whole wall of, at the time, I didn't know the term, but craft beers. And I was kind of looking at them and thinking, yeah, maybe this is worth trying something new. And so I ended up getting Anchor Steam, the first good beer I ever had. And brought it home, cracked open a bottle, tasted it, and practically spit it out because it was so strong and hoppy and flavorful compared to the beer that I was used to drinking. And my first thought is, oh, this is terrible. But on second thought, I was kind of like, well, I can see how this is an acquired taste and people could like this. And so I just sort of kept at it. I kept drinking the rest of the six pack and I tried a lot of other new beers and really just fell in love with beer through doing that.
And for folks that they may have heard the term, but may not be sure exactly what that means. Could you describe to folks what exactly craft beer is?
It's hard to describe what craft beer is, actually. There's, depending on who you ask, there's a lot of different definitions. The Brewers Association, which is the sort of trade group for brewers, defines it based on production level and ownership. If you're making less than this many barrels a year, and if you're not part of a controlled entity group or something. But to me, if somebody is making a beer and they care about the beer, it's craft. It doesn't matter if it's good or bad or how many barrels a year. If they're making it because they love beer, then I would consider it a craft beer. Sam Adams would be a good example. A lot of people look at Sam and they say, well, you know, they're making so many barrels, it's not really craft anymore. But I do believe that everyone from the executives down to the brewers and the sales reps, they all care about the product that they're producing and selling. And so that makes it craft beer in my mind.
And Sam Adams, that was like the first craft beer, right?
It was early and probably the first to be very successful. Anchor actually was probably one of the earliest breweries out there, earliest craft breweries. But, you know, breweries like Anchor and Sierra Nevada started, I think, in the late 70s or early 80s, and Boston Beer making Sam Adams. They really paved the way for what's happening today in beer. I cannot imagine how difficult it was to run those businesses back at a time when, you know, literally people didn't drink anything except for Bud and Miller. And it's crazy to think how much of a struggle it must have been for them to get those beers out and to be as successful as they are today.
In what time frame was this?
I probably should go look this up before I answer, but I believe Sierra Nevada was started in the early 80s, around 82 or 83. I think Boston Beer was mid-80s. Anchor was acquired actually quite a bit earlier than that. I want to say it was the late 60s.
Okay.
But I... like I said, I hope nobody fact checks me on that because I probably got the dates all wrong.
And if you do fact check, folks, it's fine. You can put it in the comments. Before you started Fat Bottom, you did homebrewing, correct?
Yep. I was a homebrewer. I brewed at home for about 10 years before starting the brewery.
Okay. For folks that maybe have never brewed beer before or don't understand a lot about the process, could you start by describing the process? And it may be, again, I've never brewed before. But I'm not sure if it's different between home brewing and the production that you do here. But maybe start with home brewing and kind of talk about the process a little bit.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's interesting is what people do making beer at home. It is really the same procedure that we follow making brew on a big scale. There's a lot more quality checks, a lot more sophisticated equipment in a production brewery, but the science and the magic of beer, it really is the same thing. And I mean, beer is magic. It's one of the things I love about it, that from just four basic ingredients, you can create everything from a light American lager up to a Russian Imperial Stout, really just from nothing but barley and water and hops and yeast. It's an amazing beverage. So for making beer, really what you do is you start with your grain and you mill it. You're exposing the starch and the enzymes that occur inside that barley when it's malted. You mix it with hot water, and that hot water essentially activates those enzymes. It takes all that starch and it breaks it down to simple sugars that can be fermented. So that's called mashing. You then drain off that liquid, and typically you'd rinse the grain with hot water to extract as much of that sugar as possible. You take this liquid now that looks like beer, but it's just this sort of sweet, almost syrupy liquid. It's called sweet wort.
Sweet what? Say that again.
Wort.
Sweet wort. Okay.
Yeah. It's spelled W-R-O-T and pronounced wort. So you take the wort and put it into your kettle, bring it up to a boil, and add hops into the process. So hops are to beer like grapes are to wine, and since there's just hundreds of varieties out there, they're grown all over the world, and different varieties have very different properties. So some hops are very high in alpha acids, which is the bitterness that you get in beer. Some of them are very aromatic. They might smell and taste like citrus and grapefruit, or they might be piney, or they might be herbaceous or woody or earthy or floral. And so a big part of coming up with a new recipe is determining what the grain and the hop profile need to be like and what ingredients you need to use to get that. So we boil the wort, add the hops in. The longer you cook those hops for, the more bitterness you extract from them. Later additions will release a lot of oils into the beer, and those oils do boil off over time. So you want to add those very late if you want to get a lot of flavor and aroma out of them. After the boil, you cool the beer down, down to around 68 degrees, add yeast in. And yeast begins basically ferments. It absorbs all the oxygen that's in that liquid, and it begins multiplying the oxygen. Once the oxygen runs out, it begins consuming all the sugar and turning it into alcohol and carbon dioxide. And that is what beer is. Now, it's still warm and it's flat, but it is a beer at this point. And then from there, you carbonate and package it. Home brewers would typically carbonate in a bottle by letting it re-ferment in the bottle. It takes a couple of weeks. In a production brewery, we will typically bubble carbon dioxide through the beer and let it dissolve in that way. We can get it carbonated in a couple of hours by doing that.
So home brewers, they don't actually pump carbonation into it to get it to carbonate, is it?
Some home brewers might if they're kegging, but most home brewers are putting their beer into bottles and letting it re-ferment or bottle condition in there.
So if you just put it in a bottle, like you're putting it into bottles and you're putting, are these like plastic bottles and you're just twisting the cap on, or how does it?
Glass bottles, like usually long necks, just like you find in the store. And you crimp the cap on. You would typically put a little bit more sugar into the beer.
Sure.
So the yeast has something to eat. But yeah, I mean, if you go into a homebrewer's closet, you'll find cardboard cases full of unlabeled long neck bottles.
The carbonation just sort of naturally forms then?
Yeah, so what's happening is the yeast is continues to eat that sugar, and it's producing carbon dioxide, but because it's a sealed container, it just builds up pressure, and that pressure allows that CO2 to dissolve into the beer and carbonate it.
That's really interesting. What were one or two of the first beers that you made as a homebrewer?
The first beer I made as a homebrewer was a pale ale, and then I made an India pale ale, and those were from kits. Basically, I got started because my wife said I was buying too much beer. She brought home a book one day and said, you need to learn how to make it. You're spending too much money, which she immediately regretted because the house then fills up with, you know, bottles and beer equipment in the bathtub, and it makes a big mess. But yeah, I made a pale ale from a kit, which means I got a sort of a malt syrup and I got some hops and made a small batch that way, and just immediately said, I love this. I love doing this, and ended up getting an all grain setup so I could actually do a true mash and have a little more control over my recipes.
Mm. And what do you mean by mash?
So the steeping of the grain with the hot water to extract that starch and sugar with beginner kits. That step has been done, and then it's kind of boiled down into the syrup. So you basically mix the syrup with water, and you have wort. But once you get a little more equipment, you can do the mash yourself, which requires a cooler and a false bottom and sparge arm and a lot of different things. But it lets you basically formulate your own recipe from grain all the way to the bottle.
Let's talk about canning a little bit. I know you guys do all your canning right here in your brewery. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Could you describe to folks the canning process?
The canning, it certainly depends on the machine you're using. We used to have a much smaller line from a company in Calgary. Essentially, the cans arrive to us. They're printed with the branding on them already, but there's no cap on them. So it's just an open-ended can. On our older line, the cans were filled sort of open to the atmosphere and before being filled. We upgraded that line. The current one is actually... it's this head that comes down and it seals the can and purges it with CO2, and then fills the can while it's a sealed environment, which just gives you lower oxygen pickup and better quality in the beer. But essentially, you know, the beer is carbonated and ready to drink. It's put into the can, and then the cap or the end is put on top and then seamed onto it. So it's literally crimped on. It's a mechanical seal that holds everything together.
And it wasn't up until recently that you guys started doing any bottling, is that correct?
That's right. We just started bottling a few weeks ago. We only bottle one beer right now. It's a specialty beer, a bourbon barrel-aged stout. But we're going to begin bottling some other products. Basically, anything that's more of a sort of high-end premium, so sour beers, barrel-aged, things like that, we're reserving four bottles. But most of our beer we put out into cans right now.
And what was the reason behind your decision to... just focus on beer in cans and on tap as opposed to incorporating bottles as well originally?
Well, a lot of people think it had to do with cost, but the can itself is really, it's about the same cost as a bottle and cap. For me, the decision came down to one is a can is just a better package for beer. Sometimes it has a bad reputation because a lot of cheap beer has gone into cans. But it is just overall better. There's no light transmission. There's less headspace compared to a bottle. And on top of that, the can is better for the environment. They're lighter, which means you can ship a lot more in a truck and use less fuel doing it. And they're more recyclable. More people recycle aluminum than glass.
One of the things you just mentioned there was light transmission. Now, what I've heard is that the freshest beer you can get is draft beer out of the tap. But aside from that, cans are the freshest and are generally going to preserve more of the flavor than bottles. Could you describe why that is?
Yeah, there's two main things that we look at from a quality perspective. And one of those is light in the beer. When beer is hit by UV light, there's a chemical reaction that occurs and it creates skunkiness. So, I mean, I'm sure everybody's had a skunky beer before. That basically comes from the beer being exposed to light, particularly like fluorescent lighting, bad for it. In fact, the reason that breweries use brown bottles, or good breweries use brown bottles, is because it blocks most of that UV light. So anything coming in a clear bottle or a green bottle is... basically, it's the brewery saying they don't care what the beer tastes like when it gets to you. It's all about marketing. So obviously the can stops any light from being passed through. And then oxygen is the other issue. If you have too much oxygen inside the package, the beer will essentially oxidize and it turns to a, it tastes almost like wet newspaper or cardboard. It's a very distinctive flavor once you sort of understand what you're tasting. So our target here at Fat Bottom is less than 75 parts per billion of oxygen inside the package. And our canning line will typically run at about 30 to 35 parts. So we're well under our benchmark. Once you get over that line, the beer tends to just have a much shorter shelf life where it still tastes good. So yeah, it's just, it's really, really important to us to keep that number as low as possible.
Now, I want to kind of give a little shout out to you because I don't know if folks listening have tried any beer from Fat Bottom, but their beer is, it's really good.
Thank you.
It's really exceptional, which is one of the reasons I'm talking to Ben. If you haven't tried it before, especially if you live in Nashville, I definitely would recommend either picking up some of the beer in your local store and cans or some of their new lines that they're doing in bottles or coming out and checking out their hop yard. I actually was out there earlier before we did the interview. I got here a little early and they have some pretty good food too. I had a black bean burger. I don't eat meat and their fries were good. I think it's like, is it, they put sea salt on those? I mean, there's some chunks.
Yeah, we actually do a hop salt on the fries.
Hop salt, okay.
We take hops and essentially infuse them into the salt. It's almost like macerating, like you do with sugar and citrus, and then use that for the fries. So you get a little bit of sort of aromatic out of the salt too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, if folks listening, if they want to pick up some of your beer, do they have to be in Nashville to do that?
So we only distribute in Tennessee right now, but we are covering the whole state. Obviously, most of our beer is here in Nashville, just the most points of distribution. But, you know, certainly somebody in Knoxville or in Memphis can find it.
And if folks want to find it in stores or in bars, if they can't get out here to the brewery, where can folks find your beer?
So, I couldn't list off every single bar in Tennessee, but... I mean, what I would tell folks is for our beer or for any brewery that you love and you want to have their beer, just asking goes a long way. If your local bar or your local grocery store doesn't carry the beer, just go and tell a manager you wish they would. And that really, really helps us or helps whatever brewery you're trying to support. It means a lot to us to hear that from the stores that people are asking for it specifically by name.
What would you say your flagship beer is? Would it be your red ale?
Yeah, we kind of internally, we say our flagships are our red ale, knockout IPA, and our golden ale. Mm-hmm. Those are the three beers we put in our 16-ounce cans. The vast majority of our volume is knockout IPA, probably 60 or 65% of our liquid is just that one beer. And then, you know, the red ale and the golden ale are very close behind it in terms of filling out, you know, I don't know, 95% of the liquid volume is those three beers.
You've let me sample several different beers today and all of which are fantastic. So I can't really say, I don't know if I have a favorite yet, but I have had your red ale in cans as well as your IPA. And the red ale, it's really good, folks. It tastes, I was talking to you before this, it tastes almost like grapefruit juice. Like if you just took some ruby red grapefruits and squeezed them in a glass and added some carbonation, could you describe to folks how you're able to get that citrus flavor in there?
Yeah, so a lot of people actually ask me that if we do put grapefruit in the beer, because it is called Ruby, and we don't. I mean, it is a true beer with nothing but those four base ingredients. The grapefruit that people get out of that beer, it comes from Cascade hops, which have a very specific grapefruit and citrus aroma. And so we're using those hops through most of the boil, and that is the flavor and aroma of grapefruit that you get from that beer. I like Ruby a lot because it's a very balanced beer. It's got a fairly complex grain bill, a lot of sort of caramel and toast on the front end, and then you've got that hoppiness and that citrus on the back that kind of cleans it out and makes it just a well-balanced beer.
And I am probably jumping the gun because we're not close to finishing yet, but if folks don't live local, can they order your beer online? Is there any way for it to be shipped?
We don't do any kind of online beer sales.
Okay.
I mean, basically you have to come to Tennessee right now. So soon we'll be out, but you know, we built this new facility because we just couldn't keep up with demand in our old place. And so we're still backfilling all the demand that we've got in state and making sure everybody's satisfied before we go out of state.
Let's talk about flavor a little bit. Now, you mentioned that with your Ruby Red Ale, that it's just those basic four ingredients. You're not adding any additional flavors. Now, aren't some beers, aren't there like different flavors infused? Not necessarily the beers you brew, but in general, when brewers are making beers, don't they infuse certain flavors and things in?
Yeah, just depending on what the brewery is trying to do. There's a lot of different things you can put in beer. We make beer that has cherry or lychee in it. We make beer with coffee in it. We make beer with pumpkin and spices. So really just depending on the style and what you're trying to accomplish as a brewer, there's a lot of different things that you can put in the beer to highlight or accentuate, the grain and the hops and the water and yeast that you're using.
What beer that you guys make, what are you really feeling right now in terms of your beer?
So I'm right now at home. I've got a keg of our cherry Berliner Weiss, which is it's a German wheat beer. It's tart. I mean, it's a sour beer, but it has this cherry in there. So it's sort of a hazy pink color. It's a really good beer coming into the warm weather right now. And then the beer that I'm excited about is we've got a new spring seasonal coming out, which is a saison that we're making with prickly pear flour. It's all the small batches we've done have been awesome. So I'm really, really excited to get that beer produced and out into the market.
And I can vouch, I did have some of the, say it again, is the cherry one?
We call it tart cherry Berliner Weiss.
Tart cherry Berliner Weiss, if I said that correctly. Yeah, I did have some of that before, and it is very good. As Ben was saying, it's something that's really tasty coming here into the warm weather. And is that something you guys only sell in? Do you sell kegs of that, or do you sell cans?
Yeah, it's draft only. We've got a couple different beers we do only in draft, and part of the motivation there is we wanted something that was just for retailers, for bars and restaurants. Mm-hmm. Certainly we want people to go out into Kroger and, get a 4-pack of Ruby or Knockout, but we have a lot of things we want to make. And, we have a lot of things that we want to give to those restaurants and just say, thank you for being supportive, certainly pour Knockout if that's what your customers want, but we want to get other products out there that, that people can get excited about.
Very cool. And if someone wanted to actually buy a keg, can they come to your brewery and buy a keg, like an individual, or do you have to be a bar to do that?
So right now we can't. State law, because we do wine and spirits in the restaurant, we cannot sell anything to go. We've got a space set aside here where we're going to build a small beer store. We've got that off-premise permit, but we can't do it right now. Right now it has to go through a distributor and then go out to a bar or a package store.
And I know we were talking about this a little bit before the interview, but why is it that you guys don't just focus on beer in terms of your hop yard? And just to describe to folks, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, but when we talk about your hop yard, we're talking about, I guess a quote unquote tap room that's both indoors and outdoors. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've got a sort of bar and dining room inside, but we also have a big courtyard outside.
Where you also have cornhole?
Cornhole. We've got a little stage so we can do some live music. We've got some area for kids to run around and play. When I first opened the brewery, I was about to have my first child, and I wanted a place. I wanted to create a space where I could come with my family. So mm-hmm. it's not a bar scene. It's not a dive bar at all. We've really carried that over when we moved here to West Nashville, where, we've got this sort of contained courtyard space where the kids can run around and, mom and dad can sit at a table and enjoy a beer and have dinner and not worry that, that their kids are running out into the street. So
why did you guys decide to also serve wine and cocktails in addition to your beer?
So there was really two things there. One is there's always somebody who comes in who's excited about beer, but their spouse or girlfriend or boyfriend doesn't like beer. And so we wanted to have something to offer to those people as well. And then number two is we have an event space here as well. So we can do weddings and corporate events. And in that situation, you have to be able to offer wine and cocktails. And so, you know, we were getting the permit anyways, and it made sense to have it on both sides of the house.
Very cool. Let's talk about design a little bit, because one of the things that I was personally really impressed with when I first discovered your beer, because I was in, of all places, a Walgreens. I was, and folks may hear this in other interviews I'm doing, because I think I mentioned this. I was getting ready to go to Guadeloupe about a year ago, and I hadn't had a vacation in a while. I think I felt like I just needed to get out of the country and clear my head. So I tried to find the cheapest place I could get to. And so I bought a one-way ticket to Guadeloupe, and I needed to get some shots. I can't remember what the shots was, if it was TB or something like that. But yeah, I needed to get some medicine to make sure that I didn't get sick while I was over there. And so it somehow clicked with me. It was probably a week, I want to say. It may have been 2 weeks, but I think it was a week, 8 days or something before I was leaving. And I was like, oh no, I need to actually get medicine. And so basically I did some research, and what I found was that if I wanted to get a shot, which would have been the easiest route to go, the shot needed to happen, like, I want to say 2 weeks before I left in order for it to be effective. And I'm already pretty much a week before leaving, and so the shot's not going to work even if I get it. So the only other option was I could take a pill, I think like once a day or once every other day for, I think, 7 or 8 days. And it was just enough time before I left, but I had to get the medicine that day. And I remember being in Nashville, and I called around to all the pharmacies, and there was only one place that had it. It was Walgreens. And I needed to get a prescription, but like all the travel clinics had closed, but there was like a nurse on site at the Walgreens that was willing to write me the prescription. So, or nurse practitioner, I guess. And, so I ended up getting it last minute. I go in there, and by the grace of God, I get my prescription. It's pretty late at night. And before I was heading out to Guadeloupe, I was actually going up to New York. I was leaving that night. And so I was staying with a friend, because this was right before I moved, and I was sort of going up there to crash and look at some apartments. And so I wanted to bring some beer, you know, I wanted to bring some beer from Nashville up there with me. And so I was in the Walgreens, and I kind of poked around, and I saw, oh, what is this? Fat Bottom Brewing Company. And it was your cans, 4 cans in a box. And I think I grabbed your Ruby and also your IPA, and I brought it up to New York, stayed with a couple of friends, and yeah, we really enjoyed it. I really liked your beer, and that's when I first became a fan. And I wanted to ask a few questions about some of your design choices. So the first question I want to ask is pretty simple. Why did you decide to go with a 16-ounce can versus a 12-ounce can?
Well, one is I always like to have a true pint of beer. I don't like that, 12 ounces in a 16-ounce glass doesn't look that great. Two is it just kind of makes sense with the name of the brewery being Fat Bottom, as you need a big can to go along with it. And then three is just that nobody else in town was doing 16-ounce cans at that time. In fact, I don't think anybody was doing cans of any kind, maybe. But It was something where I knew we could stand out on the shelf by doing that. And then I also knew that the 16-ounce cans would open up some other opportunities for festivals and sales at the, you know, Titan Stadium and things like that, where one, bottles wouldn't be an option, and then two is 12-ounce cans would generally not be sold in a venue like that. So it just opened up some new sales avenues for us.
And why the 4-pack?
Well, 6-pack of 16 is a lot of beer. Nobody needs that much at one sitting. It's good. It's good for the price point on the shelf. We're pretty aggressive with our pricing. A lot of craft beers will be $10 or $12 or $14 for a 6-pack, and that's just a lot of money for a beer. So the price that we're selling to retailers at, most of them are having it a 4-pack on the shelf for $6 or $6.50, which is very attractive next to a $14 6-pack.
And another thing I want to describe about your packaging, and feel free to elaborate on this. When you pick up your cans, they're not coming in, a thing where there's just a line of plastic around the top, loose plastic, and you grab it. I mean, these things are in a box, and you open the box, cardboard box, which is, I guess, on all sides of the beer, and then pull the beer out. Why did you decide to do packaging that way?
Again, a piece of it was just being distinctive on the shelf. You don't see a lot of cartons like that. The other reason is that those snap-on rings that you see a lot of craft beer in, I really don't like.
You're talking about the hard plastic ones?
The hard plastic ones, mm-hmm. Yeah. That was an option I looked at, but it's, to use a phrase from my software engineering days, just a bad user experience. They're really hard to get the cans out, and you shake it up by just the action of getting it out. And I just don't like those snap rings. I didn't think it really worked with our brand very much either. I just didn't like the look of it. So we made that decision to steer away from those ringers and go to a carton. And the carton's nice too because it gives you a bit of a billboard on a shelf. You just have more area to display the brand and tell people what's inside the package.
That makes sense. That totally makes sense. Let's talk about the name. How did you come up with the name Fat Bottom?
So I had, I get that question a lot. And I, almost 5 years in now, I still don't have a good story around it. Basically, I started with a list of a couple hundred names. I mean, I just sat down and wrote everything I could think of and kind of whittled down the list as I went. I had a lot of geographic names, things like Music City Brewing and Nashville Brewing Company. Those are great for selling beer in Nashville, but they don't really have a lot of relevance when you go outside town or outside Tennessee. And I kind of struck those off the list. On my short list, the very first name on the list was Fat Ass Brewing, which I liked, but it was kind of over the edge, right? It's going to make it hard to sell the beer. Mm-hmm. So I liked the idea, and I kind of took it and kept massaging it and thinking about it, and it kind of led me to Fat Bottom. Mm-hmm. And that spoke to me as, what I want to do with making beer. Obviously, it's distinctive. I mean, one of the big problems breweries face now is there's so many breweries out there. It's really hard to get people to try the beer for the first time. And so I knew I wanted a name and a package that would stand out on the shelf, right? If you can get somebody to taste the beer the first time, and if there's good liquid in the can, then they'll come back and buy it again. But it is that first purchase that's really, really hard for a lot of breweries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, next I want to talk about the logo, and I know you guys have your standard logo, the circle that says Fat Bottom Brewing Company, but then for each of your different canned beers, correct me if I'm wrong, you have a slightly custom logo for each of those. Could you talk about that? Because each of them have, it sort of reminds me of somewhat of a throwback, but there's, a young lady, and she's, they all have beer in their hands. And could you describe that and kind of the thought process behind that?
Yeah. So, when we were talking about, the logo originally, the inspiration behind it was World War II bomber nose art, having the pinup girl on there. And so, so that's kind of where the concept came from. And then basically took that and said, well, I want each beer that I produce to have a different personality. So each beer has its own girl that goes with it, its own name, and kind of its own personality in the logo. So, I don't know. When I look at these logos, and we are looking at three of these logos that are big up on the wall here in this room, each one is designed to sort of express the personality of the beer and how I imagine people drinking it. Ruby, I've always thought of as sort of a summertime beer. So she's wearing a baseball cap and is kind of ready for a day at a game in the summer. And Ginger has red hair, obviously. And Knockout is, she's a boxer. Mm-hmm. And
all of the women in these logos do sort of have fat bottoms on brand, even though that, I guess, the Bertha, the oatmeal stout, you can't, I guess her back is more to the ground instead of facing us. Is that?
Yeah, it's that was sort of a core part of those logos. We're actually kind of in the middle of a rebrand and shifting away from that a little bit. So we still have the pinup girls, but we wanted to sort of tone it down a little bit. Yes, so you still have that idea of the girl and the personality and all that, but it's a little more discreet.
For me, it's a little bit edgy, but I really appreciate attention to detail, aesthetics, beauty. But yeah, I do think that the fact that, to me, you know, representing a beautiful woman and what I think your beer is, which is a beautiful beer, and that sort of analogy, I do really appreciate. And I mean, other people may interpret it differently, but yeah, I really dig it. And I dig that sort of, like you were saying, the World War II sort of throwback. I personally, as someone who appreciates design and aesthetics, I really dig it. So
thank you.
I still want to talk about design and aesthetics a little bit more, but I want to move more into your hop yard, your indoor dining space. Like I said, I got here a little early, and before we met, I was just having some lunch and preparing a little bit. And there was a lot of things I noticed. I really love the ambiance in there. It's a really, really positive feeling place, very comfortable. And it's funny, when we were talking, you know, before the interview, you're telling me that one of your hobbies is woodworking. It sort of started coming alive, because there's a lot of natural wood in terms of how you guys built out the bar and the tables and things. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So we actually ended up moving the bar and a lot of the tables from our East Nashville location. And one of the things that I love about that furniture is we had a sort of artist in the neighborhood who built it when we first opened up. Those tables and the bar top are all made from the same piece of wood. It was all one tree that he took and milled down and created all these different slabs and built all this furniture from.
And so not just the bar, like all of the tables are all from one tree.
Every tabletop and the whole bar top is all the same tree.
Wow, that's impressive. What kind of tree was that?
Poplar.
Poplar.
Yeah, which is the state tree of Tennessee. So
very, very on brand. Very on brand there. Yeah, one thing that was really interesting to me, and I was really nerding out design-wise when I was sitting in that room. Talk about the chairs for the tables, because they're a little bit different. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, they are. They're heavy, for one. Mm-hmm. The chairs are sort of similar story. They're made of walnut, but again, all the same tree. And it's basically a big steel frame. One of the sort of mandates I gave this guy when he started making the furniture, I said, make me something that's going to be around 100 years after I die. I just wanted something that's just rock solid, you know, would be very durable and kind of stand the test of time. So he set out with that mission, and most of the seating we have is shared seating, is benches, because we wanted sort of a community feel, a neighborhood feel, and it also sort of throws back to, I think, old German beer halls with the big communal tables, and so most of the seating in there at all the tables is shared benches.
Mm-hmm. And so I'll just kind of describe some of these benches a little bit. Like he was saying, the tables are made of wood as well as the benches. And then they have this sort of steel frame underneath them. But one of the things that's a little bit different about these benches is that, for example, the table I was sitting at, I guess it could seat two people on each side. So four people total at the table. But the benches pull out like a chair. They don't, it's not a bench that's, it's not like a picnic table where the entire table and benches are all stuck together. And that was a bit different. I could sort of pull this sort of like a very wide two-seater chair out and sit down. Yeah, that was a really interesting design aesthetic.
Thank you. Yeah, that's one of the favorite things in that room is that furniture.
Yeah, it's very cool. What about the there's also some people out there may not know what this is, but if you're very young, but there's a phone booth in your, can you talk about that?
There is, yeah. When we bought this land, there used to be a small warehouse on the property, and basically the only thing left in it was this old phone booth. So yeah, it's an old payphone, and I was really hoping to get it operational and use it as the bar phone, but we have not found a key to get inside of it yet. So it's hung up, and it's kind of becoming our sticker wall. So whenever people visit from other breweries, that kind of stuff, they're throwing stickers up on it. I'm sure it'll get covered up and have a lot of history in it from that space too. But yeah, it is an old payphone sitting in there from South Central Bell.
Very cool. Very cool. Another thing I wanted to ask about, and we're still talking about design here. One of the things, and I started to notice this before I even met you, when I opened up your original package, right? I pulled the can out. I got a 16-ounce can and a 4-pack can of beer, which is boxed, which is very unique, and I'm drinking the beer and it's delicious. I'm noticing an attention to detail that I really appreciated, and I feel like a lot of folks don't do attention to detail. Why is that important to you?
It's one of those things that's hard to explain. Anybody who started a business, I think, gets it, that every little detail counts. Everything is a part of the experience when somebody is going to be drinking the beer, or when they come into the restaurant, or when they tour the brewery. Everything's a little detail. And I think there's a lot of things that some people don't pick up on or couldn't point out, but it becomes part of that overall experience. I always have felt like if I can take care of all the little details, then the whole will take care of itself.
Mm-hmm. My mind was being blown because the more exposure to your brand I get, the more I'm like, whoa. Like, for example, when I was done with my meal, the server brought my check out, and it wasn't on a traditional black book that you open up and your receipts in there for you to pay. Could you describe what that looks like?
Yeah, we essentially had little clipboards made from reclaimed wood. So it's got that clip on the top, but then it's probably a half inch thick slab of essentially like old weathered wood. And that's, again, you know, we would have been perfectly fine using a black check presenter or a plastic tray, but it just becomes a part of that overall experience, and it ties in with the aesthetic in that space. And like you're saying, just the attention to detail, saying if we can make this a good part of the experience, then that adds to the whole.
Let's talk about people a little bit. Now, what have you learned as someone who is managing other people? Are there any best practices that you've discovered to help foster that company culture that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a business writer by any means, but one of the things that I always try to keep in mind, and I try to train into other managers, is the people that I work with are very passionate about the things they do, right? And that's one of the reasons I want to have them here. But that can also translate into very aggressive management when something is not going right, because they care so deeply about everything being right. And so I always try to sort of take a step back and be very analytical, set aside emotion, and say, you know, if I run into an issue, what is actually happening here? What is the underlying cause, right? What is it that I need to fix to stop this from happening? Not just how do I stop the symptoms of the problem? And what happens is when somebody's passionate and they speak with passion, it can come across as aggressive or rude or demanding. When really we're all trying to accomplish the same thing, right? We're all trying to make the business better. We're all trying to sell more beer. We're all trying to make the customers happier over in the hop yard. But when those issues come up, you just have to be able to take a step back and say, how do I fix the underlying problem without injecting my emotion into what's happening here?
Mm. Now, I want to talk about the recipes a little bit, not some of the details, but what I was going to ask you is, and we talked about this a little bit before the interview, but how much of the recipes are things that you're developing creatively versus your head brewer?
So a lot of the recipes we have now are actually beers I started making as a home brewer. So Ruby is a good example. That's a beer I made as a home brewer. It took me several years to figure out the right grain mixture. And it's something I brought in and said, we're going to make this beer. Other beers are collaborative. We're about to release a pale ale. And that beer, it basically started off as a call to the company. Anybody who wanted to come in and make a test batch could do that. We then did a blind tasting of all these different beers. We just said, it needs to be in this style. Did a blind tasting. Everybody kind of graded from top to bottom the beers they liked and didn't like, and kind of the notes of what they liked about each beer. And then we took the top two beers, which were truly coincidentally, the number one pick was my head brewer's and the number two pick was mine. Basically started merging those recipes and kind of massaging and really trying to refine that beer into what it's going to be when it hits the shelves. So a lot of it is collaborative in that sense. Even when it's something, the Berliner Weiss, for example, is a good example. That is a recipe that came almost entirely from our head brewer. But the concept started off as something that we created as a team, right? We said, this is the kind of beer we want. This is the message we want to get across with the flavors we want in there. Now, Drew, go out and figure out how you're going to make that beer and how you're going to keep it interesting and fresh on every batch.
Mm-hmm. I think I want to just talk about a funny anecdote just to break it up a little bit. But I was sitting down with Bob Bernstein, founder of Bongo Java, and interviewing him. And one of the things that I was telling him that I was kind of nervous about was interviewing the two of you because your names sound so similar.
Yeah.
So we got Bob Bernstein and Ben Bredesen, both B first name, B last name, but a short first name, and then a two or three syllable last name. And you guys are both kind of sort of in the beverage space in a way, coffee versus beer. And he's like, yeah, and both of our dad's names are Phil too. And I'm like, what? So I was a little bit nervous that I wouldn't get tongue twisted. So back to beer. How do you guys make your beer so darn good? And you were kind of hinting at it a little bit with the testing and things you were just mentioning, but
yeah, it's making good beer once is not that hard. Making good every time is really, really, really hard. One of the things that we've invested in is a quality lab. And we've invested in a lot of different equipment and processes and everything else. But the lab in particular, it's one of those things, it's a hard sell because it's not like buying a new tank where you say there's direct revenue that comes out of this and here's how we're going to grow the business. But you have to have it as a brewery. You know, we want to grow. We want to be a regional and a national brewery someday. And we knew that we were going to have that beer go out the door exactly the same every single time. And so we spent a lot of time and money getting the right tools, the right equipment, and the right people in place to manage that quality program. The thing that's really important and the kind of the advice I'd give to anybody who's starting a brewery is start with consistency, and then once you've got your baseline, then think about how you make the beer better and better. If you start just saying, well, I can make it better by doing this, the beer's gonna be good for one or two batches, but it may be totally different after that. And you've got to have the data and the analytics and that information to understand where the beer is going different. Why is it different? You know, if it's better, why wasn't? If it's worse, then why was it? It's a very hard thing to invest in as a young brewery or as a startup, but it's so critical to ensuring longevity, ensuring that the product you're putting out the door is as good as possible.
Mm. What year did you guys start?
Let's see. We opened the doors August 2012.
August 2012. Okay. And then how long did it take from the time that you said, hey, look, I want to transition from home brewer Ben to brewery owner Ben? How long was that process to get those doors open?
I think it was January of 2011 is when I made the decision to go. And then it was September of that year that I actually quit my job and signed a lease and started work. So we were open, 11 months after signing a lease, or 10 months after signing a lease, something like that, which is really, really fast. Looking back at it, I'm really surprised I was able to get it done that fast. I think most new breweries probably take 14, 16, 18 months to actually get the doors open.
How were you guys able to do it so fast?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, part of it was just the pressure and pushing, because I wanted to be open in the summer when, you know, the beer business is very strong. It's a very seasonal business, just drops mm-hmm. off in the winter. Part of it was not going overboard with what we were doing. The thing about our old tap room, while the design was important and the elements were important, it was a pretty sparse space that had sort of the central points of the bar and the furniture we had made, but also just the building itself. So we didn't have to do a lot to that space. Same thing in the brewery. You know, once we got the floor set and the drain set, it was just a matter of getting the equipment in place. So I wouldn't say I set out with a plan of I'm going to get the doors open 10 months later, but it worked out that way just fortuitously based on the decisions we made.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a co-founder when you first started?
Nope. I was the only one.
And what were those first steps? Did you need to raise money, or did you just kind of bootstrap from the money you had made in software?
Yeah, it was basically bootstrapped from my past experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when did you basically bring on your first hire, and who was that hire? Like, what role were they playing?
The first person I hired was a taproom manager. I have never worked behind a bar, waited at a table, worked in a kitchen. I knew I needed somebody who knew how to do that. So I hired that person early on before opening the doors and made sure that, you know, I had somebody who could go out and hire a wait staff and could set up a kitchen and, you know, knew health department rules and those kinds of things I just didn't have any experience with. On the brewery side, the first person I hired was a sales rep. You know, that was a case, like I said, I was trying to do everything. It just wasn't realistic. I just couldn't actually make the beer and package the beer and sell the beer and all that. And so I hired a guy who would go out and represent the brand and then actually make those deliveries, because we were self-distributing early on.
And how did you find those guys?
The sales rep I hired, he actually lived down the street from me. He had had a business selling sort of natural products and home goods. And ended up closing that down. But I knew, you know, he enjoyed beer and he liked what I was doing and, you know, had that business experience. He'd be a good face for the brand. For the restaurant, I had talked to several different people, it was actually somebody who had contacted me independently, kind of cold called me. He had heard about the brewery opening and just said, hey, this is my experience. I'd love to be a part of it. So I talked to him and then interviewed a few other folks and then ended up going with him to open the brewery.
Cool. And was the decision for not bringing on a co-founder, was that a conscious decision, or was it just you just had your idea and you're just going for it and you didn't really think much about it?
It was more just like, I'm full steam ahead and I'm going to make this happen. I talked to a couple of guys that I was friends with and I was a home brewer with about doing that. They were not in a position to do it. They had actually just started a technology company and were full steam ahead on that. And so they just weren't able to do it. I still see them occasionally at brewers conference and stuff. They're talking about opening a brewery of themselves now.
That's funny.
But you know, once that didn't happen, I didn't go out and try to find another person. It was just sort of this is somebody I would like to do business with. They can't be a part of it. That's fine. I'm gonna forge ahead on my own.
Cool. And when you guys first opened, was it just kind of a restaurant, or were you guys already distributing cans, or what was your first kind of business?
So we had the tap room, but we were selling kegs in the market.
Two bars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I set out saying I don't want to just be a brew pub. I want to, you know, be a production and distributing brewery. We sold and shipped our first keg on the same day that the tap room opened up.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get your first customers?
Just walking in the door and saying, I'm starting a business and I need your support. And, you know, at the time, there was not many local breweries. It was, I think, Yazoo and Jackalope were the only two that were open. And, it was a very easy sell to walk in and say, I'm a new local brewery and I'd like to have a tap. Today, it wouldn't really work. There's like 18 breweries in town now. While local is still important, we talk to a lot of people where, you know, that say, I want to have local taps. It's not enough to just be local with 17 other competitors out there. Mm-hmm.
And were you, when you were walking into these bars, in addition to that, were you bringing beer to like give them to taste test, or?
Yeah, I would bring them beer, give a taste, but it's always hard because it's beer that I made at home or before I had opened, before you had the production system. So, you know, I knew, and I think they knew that it wouldn't necessarily be the same product coming out of production system, but it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's a community and they gave me a shot and said, okay, I'll put it on the wall and we'll see what happens.
Very cool.
And it's, you know, I got to be thankful for that.
Do you remember the first bar that you were in?
The first keg I delivered was to Village Tavern up at Riverside Village.
Cool. Shout out to them.
Yeah.
Could you talk about oxidation a little bit? What exactly is that?
Yeah. So when we package the beer, before packaging the beer, there's essentially zero oxygen dissolved in there because the yeast scavenges it and uses it for reproduction. But once we have centrifuged out the yeast, there's no more of that pickup going on. And so we need to minimize the amount of oxygen pickup that we have. Basically, that oxygen is getting in and there's a reaction happening with compounds in the beer itself. And the result of that is this this chemical that it tastes like sort of wet newspaper or wet cardboard. And it's once you are sort of attuned to what it is, you can smell it. Like when somebody pours a beer like a couple seats away at a bar, if it's oxidized, I can smell it now in the air because it's a very, very distinctive smell. And it's very unpleasant. It's definitely tastes like a bad beer when you have an oxidized beer.
Mm-hmm. And is that something that breweries struggle with? Like occasionally their beer gets oxidized and they just have to dump it? Is that?
Well, no. I think I would say a lot of small breweries are not they're not measuring or not aware if there is a problem. The equipment to measure it is fairly expensive, and that's, you know, one of the things we invested in because we needed it for the cans. And so you really, you know, as a very small brewery, I think you just try to follow procedure and keep that oxygen pickup to a minimum, but you don't have any data points around that. Packaging in a keg is pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of atmospheric exposure, not a lot of opportunity to pick up oxygen. But when you go into the can, there's always at least a couple seconds where that foam is exposed to the air and it is picking up oxygen. And that's one of those things where we're pulling cans periodically from the line. We're running them through the test. We're looking at oxygen and carbonation level, and we're cutting open the seams, inspecting, doing a lot of other things to ensure that quality control. So it's... Oxidation really has to do a lot with your procedure as a brewery and with the equipment you're using. The old line that we used, we struggled to get under about 200 parts per billion. I told you our benchmark is 75. And this line, if we're not running it correctly, it will go high. But once we've got it dialed in and tuned, we can keep it at about half of that 75 target line, down at, you know, about 35 parts per billion.
Now, when people talk about beer volume, do they describe it in barrels? Is that correct?
Yeah. So breweries in the U.S. talk about it in terms of barrels, which is 31 gallons per barrel.
31 gallons. Yeah. Okay.
So a keg like you see at the bar is a half barrel keg. It's 15 and a half gallons.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how many barrels you guys produce a day?
Sure. So last year, before the move, we produced a little over 4,000 barrels of beer. Our goal for this year is 8,000, and we want to grow between 75 and 100% every year from here on.
So 8,000 barrels in a year,
yes.
Which is a lot of gallons.
It's a lot of gallons, yeah. So 8,000 times 31 would be, what, 240,000 gallons of beer, something like that? I think that's right. So it's a lot of liquid, for sure.
A lot of liquid. What's been your biggest challenge so far?
I think the biggest challenge we have, I always try to have a lot of forethought and be planning a couple of years down the road what we're doing. Even with that, sometimes I feel like we fall behind the curve.
How so?
Well, for example, when I was planning this new facility, the intent was always to say, okay, when we get this open, we're going to have capacity and we're going to go into, you know, we want to expand it to Kentucky and Alabama. Well, it turns out right now there's a bunch of breweries in Nashville that are about to launch in Kentucky and Alabama. And so now we're kind of looking and say, well, maybe that's not a good idea, right? I wish we had gotten those deals signed 6 months ago or 9 months ago when nobody from Nashville was in those markets. You know, realistically, we didn't have capacity. We couldn't produce beer, or we couldn't supply beer to those markets, even if we did have the contract. So it's one of those cases where we kind of, because the opening of the brewery got delayed, because I didn't really consider other breweries in Nashville going to those markets, we fell behind the curve. And now we're kind of looking at alternative options for where do we want to go next.
But you are looking to expand outside of Tennessee.
Yeah, we're backfilling kind of the demand, the residual demand from last year when we just couldn't make enough beer, and now we're looking going into new markets and really starting to use the capacity that we have in this building.
And how do you keep up with all of that demand? I know that you guys are, like you said, you're backfilling demand that's been there. How do you guys keep up with the growing demand?
It takes a lot of projection. You know, beer takes about 2 to 3 weeks to get out the door from the time you make it, from the time you brew it. And that's not a long time compared to something like wine or whiskey, but it still requires some forethought, some projection, a lot of forecasting in terms of what's the market going to do, what is the sales team going to do? Are they going to hit their goals this month and next month? So it definitely takes a lot of time with spreadsheets to sit down and kind of analyze the business, analyze the distributors, the sales team, the market to see what's going to happen.
Let's talk about the two hop Shakur.
Okay.
This is one of your beers. Can you describe to folks what exactly this is?
Yeah. So two hop is a West Coast IPA. And it's very different from Knockout IPA. Knockout is kind of what I would describe as an all-American IPA. It's, you know, fairly bitter, but it's got some balance to it. Two Hop is very resinous and earthy. West Coast IPAs tend to be much more hop-forward than traditional IPAs.
And what does hop-forward mean?
Basically it means there's a lot more hops in them. So West Coast tends to be, a lot of beers are very floral, very citrusy, just a lot of aromatic hops in there. Mm-hmm. We decided to go a little bit of a different route with this sort of earthiness and resinous, almost sort of a dank character to it. Yeah, and because it was a West Coast IPA, we decided to name it Two Hop Shakur.
And how did that name come about? Obviously, some folks, this is sounding a little familiar.
Yeah.
But talk about it.
No, it was my head brewer is a fan.
Of Tupac Shakur.
Yes. And... when he first made the beer, he suggested that name. And I was like, we need to come up with a couple of other ideas and try this and try that. And I couldn't find a name that was better suited for that beer than Two Hop.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Yeah, there's I think it's coming out this summer. There's a feature film biopic on Tupac. I think that's coming out this summer, which actually... I was involved in a small way. They were shooting back in Atlanta about a year ago. This was probably not too far from the time that I discovered your beer, but I went down to Atlanta to work on the film a little bit. I was, I'm not going to say I'm going to be in it because I'm probably not going to make the cut. I'm just assuming my scene's going to get cut out, but I was acting. I was actually playing Jeff Pollock, basically the guy that directed Above the Rim, which was a movie that Tupac acted in. I was playing him, and he also wrote, I think, and created a lot of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, that TV show. But yeah, I was playing that guy and had to shave my beard off and everything, so folks might not even recognize me. But yeah, it was a pretty fun experience being on set there and working with Benny Boom, the director, and I think his name is Demetrius. Oh gosh, I can't remember his last name off the top of hand, but he's the guy that played Tupac. So just being like so close to him and seeing like this guy looks just like Tupac, you know, was really fun because I was a big Tupac fan growing up. So it was a really cool experience just having a small part in that movie. But yeah, so your head brewer, he should is it Drew? Is that his name?
Yeah, Drew Yeager.
Drew Yeager, he should check out that movie when I think it's coming out in June. But anyway, let's get back to the building. So you guys started out in East Nashville, is that correct?
That's correct. We had about 5,000 square feet over in East Nashville, right on Main Street.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you guys in that location for?
We were there for about a little over four years.
Okay, cool. And why did you guys decide to move out here in West Nashville? I guess the Nations, is that?
Yeah, the neighborhood here is called the Nations. About 2 years into to working over there in East Nashville, I could see that we were just outgrowing that space and we were not going to be able to stay there for very long. And so I started looking for a new location for the brewery. The Nations was actually not in my original sort of search area. Mm-hmm. What I was looking for was something that was close to the downtown core, but was also in or close to a neighborhood. You know, one of the things that was important to me in East Nashville was that we had lots of folks from the neighborhood who would come down, just, you know, walk down to the brewery and hang out. And in fact, I lived just about a half mile from the old brewery, so I was able to walk to work too. But I couldn't find anything. What I, you know, what was out there was very, very expensive, and it wasn't really big enough. So I expanded the search, very quickly found this lot here in the Nations, which is the lot itself. It's industrial zone. We back up to a railroad, but it's literally across the street from housing. And, you know, immediately I said, this is where I want to be, right? This is, it's deep in the neighborhood. It's got the space we need. It's an industrial area. And it made perfect sense with, you know, what was happening in the Nations, a new business coming in, a new housing being built, and just a lot of new activity. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening here, and it feels a lot like East Nashville did about 10 or 15 years ago with the number of folks that are coming in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely want to be respectful of your time, but before we wrap up, let's say there's someone out there listening, whether it's a brewery or another business idea, they are starting to work on something, or they're thinking, they have an idea and they're thinking about working on a business idea. What would your advice be to that person?
The number one thing I would say is surround yourself with people who can do the job better than you can. It was a very hard realization for me with the brewery, but I am really happy now to have a lot of people working here who are really good at the things they do. You know, whether it is brand development or sales management or running the restaurant or managing events or doing the brewing or whatever it might be, there are people out there that you can lean on that can be very good. And you got to put a lot of sweat equity in, right? You have to build that business yourself, and it's a very hard decision to say, I'm going to put money out there and hire these people, because it's scary, right? I mean, that first year you don't have a lot of cash coming in, and it's hard to make that decision. But anything you're doing, there's somebody out there who can help you. And if you can find that person, then it gives you a leg up over the competition. It's going to help you execute better, whether it's, yeah, I don't know, you know, making clothing or a record label or, you know, fabricating in tools in a machine shop, whatever it might be. There's somebody out there who can help you do that. And you got to find that person and get them on board and excited about what you're trying to do.
Very cool. Great advice. Well, Ben, before we go, if folks want to find you online or find out more about your brewery, where can they do that?
Easiest thing would be fatbottombrewing.com at our website. We're on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all that, of course. Mm-hmm. But yeah, come check us out, and yeah, love to have people visit and get excited about what we're doing here. I mean, that's why we have the restaurants. We want people to come in, see the brewery, and be excited about the beer that we're making.
Yeah, and when you're eating in their hop yard, there you can see the brewery. Like there's glass behind the bar and the doors. Actually, could you talk about that a little bit? I feel like there's I got a feeling of transparency right there.
Yeah, I definitely want people to see the brewery. In fact, when we first built in East Nashville, there was a little bar and railing right in the brewery. People could sit there with a beer and kind of watch mm-hmm. us working. We needed to take it a step up from that and have a little bit of division and the sanitation level, improve the sanitation. But yeah, there's a lot of glass, a lot of space. People can stand and watch us working in the brewery. And, you know, I want people to see that it is sparkling clean, because, you know, we're a food manufacturing facility, right? That's really, really important. It's critically important in beer. Yeah, I just want people to see it and, like I said, get excited about what we're trying to do and how beer is made.
Yeah, it's. I had a walk through the facility. It's definitely very, very clean. Actually, they were cleaning out some of the, I guess, production containers. I was asking Ben. I was like, "What's all that hot water coming out?" And he's like, "No, we're draining for. We just did a wash through of that." One other question that I just thought about when I was thinking about my tour through the brewery. There was a little section when I first walked in on the right that had a lot of different gloves and things. Could you describe what those are like, what those gloves are used for?
Yes. Yeah, so we've got a little area. There's the brewer's desk. There's gloves and boots that are all hung up. We work with a lot of different chemicals, which are very dangerous. And so we've got PPE for all personal protective equipment for all the brewers and folks that come through that space. I have given myself many, many chemical burns over the years, and I don't want anybody else to have to deal with that. It's pretty unpleasant. So we've got all the gloves and boots and, shields and aprons and everything else hanging up there right inside the door.
And how are those chemicals used with your process?
It's all cleaning chemicals. So once we finish with the tank, obviously it's covered in beer. There's a lot of yeast and solids and other things in there. And so we run a series of cleaning cycles, which involve hot caustic lye, a cold acid, and then food safe sanitizer, which is called parasitic acid.
Okay. And this is once it's clean, once you guys go through that process, I mean, this is all safe in terms of when you're making your beer, there's no kind of chemicals in there that are going to actually hurt people drinking your beer.
No, it is pure beer. In fact, one of the upgrades we made here is we bought an automated cleaning skid because we wanted consistency and quality in the cleaning too. So it essentially runs a cleaning cycle and it checks. We don't dump the rinse down the drain. We actually bring it back to the skid and we measure the amount of chemical in that rinse water as it comes back, and we don't stop rinsing until the water comes back clean. So it's one of those things it is a big upgrade for brewery our size, but it's so important to ensure the quality and safety of the beer.
Mm-hmm. Very, very awesome. Very awesome. Okay, so folks, if you guys want to check out more about Fat Bottom, fatbottombrewingco.com.
Is that just fatbottombrewing.com?
Fatbottombrewing.com. And then do you tweet or do you have any personal publications online?
Personally, I have at Ben Hart's Beer, but I never post anything. It's been a long time. But yeah, the brewery is on there. And I'm sure if I ever post something, they will retweet me. So
very cool. Very cool. All right, Ben. Well, it's been a real pleasure hanging out with you. Thank you so much for having me in your brewery. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been fun for me too. So cheers.
Cool. Thanks. Hey guys, real quick before you go, I just wanted to let you know that you can find notes for this episode on our website, which is thestoriespodcast.com. The show notes include links to people and resources mentioned in the episode, and occasionally some pretty awesome quotes. There's also a place to leave a comment if there's anything you'd like to say, or you can write your thoughts as a review on iTunes. And if you do leave a review on iTunes, I just want to let you know I really appreciate it. It really helps create more visibility for the podcast, so thanks. Oh, and one more thing, if you do leave a review on iTunes, please put your Twitter handle at the bottom of your review. I've been known to occasionally send thank you tweets out, but no promises. See you guys next week.